the rule of law. Since the Magna Carta, the idea that the will of the rulers can be bound by law seemed like a pretty good one. On Thursday, February 26th, at 6 p.m., we the people will address war crimes and impunity. Should the Bush administration be held accountable for possible war crimes? What are the obligations of the Obama administration to restore the rule of law? Join us for a call-in show where we'll explore these questions. We'll also have an interview with Chuck Sedetik, co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confronting Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity, and Francis Boyle, University of Illinois law professor and internationally recognized expert on international law and human rights. Call us with your questions or comments, or post them before and after the show at www.kboo.fm/we the people. Just because the president doesn't, it doesn't mean it's not illegal. This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Scanner newspaper, featuring local and national news, and now providing the latest in local and national news from an African-American perspective online at www.thescanner.com. The Scanner provides daily updates that keep people informed.
I'm Lena Alialora.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brent Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barnford.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Washington State plans to detain more undocumented workers.
Intelligence analysts and civil liberties groups call for a special prosecutor to be assigned to George W. Bush.
And we take a special look at the ongoing drug war in Mexico.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, February 24th, 2009. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Linda Olsen-Osterlund. The Portland Public School Board has decided by a vote of 5-2 to proceed with a plan to include an elementary school as part of a 138-unit affordable housing development at Northwest 13th and Raleigh Street in the Pearl District. The proposed school would consist of 2, 3, or 4 classrooms with bathrooms and no other facilities. That is, there will be no library, no cafeteria, no gymnasium, no music room, just the classrooms. The capacity of the rooms has not yet been decided, but the estimate of school-aged children who will be living in the new building is 130. The proposed space will only be 14,000 square feet. The nearest public elementary school is Chapman, about a mile away, and it already serves the second largest geographic area of any elementary school in Portland. It is estimated that the population of the Pearl and downtown districts will grow in the next few years from about 33,000 people to around 77,000 people.
State regulators have shut down the Silver Falls Bank of Silverton, Oregon, making it the second Oregon bank closed in the last 2 weeks and the eighth in the nation this month. The total number of banks closed in February nationwide is the highest in over 15 years. The Silverton Bank's offices reopened on Monday as branches of the Citizens Bank of Corvallis, who bought up millions in the old bank's assets. Silver Falls was hurt by its dependence on construction loans, many of which have failed in the recent downturn.
Work is underway on an expansion to add room for nearly 600 inmates at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. The prison-like complex already holds 1,000 suspected undocumented workers. The Florida-based GEO Group, formerly known as Wackenhut Corrections Corporation, operates this facility and other detention centers across the country. The private company closed juvenile detention facilities in Louisiana and Michigan under allegations of inadequate inmate care and abuse. Over the last 2 years, federal authorities have cracked down on what they call illegal immigration in the Northwest. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency says that deportations from Washington, Oregon, and Alaska increased by 35% last year.
A number of intelligence analysts and civil liberties groups have signed an open letter to President Obama calling for a special prosecutor to be assigned to the case of George W. Bush. KABLE's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Ray McGovern, a 27-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency and one of those who signed the open letter.
Ray McGovern, what exactly are you calling for Eric Holder and the Obama administration to do at this point?
We're calling upon them to discharge their duty under the Constitution to see that the laws of the country are faithfully enforced. We have violations of the U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996, passed by a predominantly Republican Congress, that forbids torture. We have international conventions that forbid torture, and the Bush administration authorized torture by their own admission. You'll recall, Jenka, those exit interviews where Vice President Cheney in particular bragged about authorizing waterboarding. Well, waterboarding has always been an international crime ever since the Inquisition. And not only that, but President Obama has said that waterboarding is torture. So has his Attorney General, Eric Holder. And so if the President and the Vice President have admitted to ordering waterboarding, and our new President and Attorney General say that waterboarding is torture, they have no option if they are to discharge their duties under the Constitution, but to investigate whether a crime has been committed here, and if there has, then that crime should be prosecuted. No one is above the law, as the new president has said now several times.
Now, Obama has said that he will close Guantanamo, that he's opposed to torture. Have you seen him taking steps in that direction and possibly moving forward with this prosecution that you're calling for?
Well, he's been careful. You know, he's only been around for a little while now. One has to have a little patience. The closing of Guantanamo, the closing of the so-called black sites, where people were kidnapped and held without telling their wives, children, or much less the Red Cross, those kinds of things have stopped. There is some question as to whether rendition continues. But rendition, you know, that was conducted under earlier presidents. As long as there's a judicial procedure to authorize it, that's very different from the wholesale rendition that was engaged in by the Bush and Cheney administration. So there are very positive signs. The president says that he wants to look toward the future, but, you know, you can't really look toward the future when crimes have been committed or when crimes are suspected of having been committed without dealing with the past. And so, as many have said, the best way to deal with the future, the best way to look ahead is to pause long enough to see what has happened and to take the necessary measures to ensure that this does not happen again.
You yourself are a former member of the intelligence community in Washington. Do you think this is a widely held view among the intelligence community, both current and past?
Yes, it is, actually, and people don't understand that very well. You see, if you take the CIA, for example, it's really two agencies. The one agency is doing the job for which it was set up. That is to gather together, analyze, and to present to the president without fear or favor the analysis about what's going on in this or that country or this or that issue. The other part, which was an accident of history, is a part that's involved in operations. And there is a clause in the National Security Act of 1947 that permits a president, and, you know, I use this word advisedly, permits a president to use the CIA as his own personal Gestapo. And the distinction that we are making here is that contrary to those who insist on a educational attempt to, well, let's say, to set up a commission to look into all this, the evidence is abundant. The evidence hangs out there. The evidence comes from the vice president and the president's own lips. And so we need not delay this thing for 2 years with a commission investigation. What needs to happen is what used to happen. That is, the Attorney General needs to appoint a nonpartisan but very professional special prosecutor with great records, and you let that person proceed independently. And then Mr. Obama, Eric Holder, and the rest of them can do the business of the government while this person with the full authority given to it by the president, can proceed independently to take this stain off our record and to make sure that whoever was responsible for this is held accountable.
Again, we have been speaking with Ray McGovern, who is a member of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. This is Janka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tomorrow's weather is some rain with a high of 49.
The current time is 5:13, and now time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The report cards have come out, and I'm afraid we're just not making the grade. I'm talking about the infrastructure report card issued every 4 years by the American Society of Civil Engineers. The engineers do an analysis of the condition of 15 categories of our country's crucial infrastructure, including roads, drinking water, parks, schools, and levees. The latest report scores us a big fat D. Our actual performance is even worse than this poor grade indicates, for America was rated a D-plus in 2001, meaning our officials have let these public assets deteriorate further in the past 8 years. The engineering group says that our leaders ignore essential upkeep on our national house, relying on what the group calls patch-and-pray fixes. The group reports that it'll take a concerted national effort costing $2.2 trillion over the next 5 years to lift America to a grade of A, where we belong. That's 18 times the size of the infrastructure funding in President Obama's current recovery plan. But at least his plan makes a significant start for moving our country in the right direction. Meanwhile, there's another plan that the Obamacans are said to be considering that has special merit. It's a grassroots proposal to reactivate the enormously successful Civilian Conservation Corps that Roosevelt launched in the Great Depression. The revitalized CCC would enlist thousands of young Americans in all 50 states, putting them to work on the huge backlog of reconstruction projects so urgently needed on the 700 million acres of both urban and rural public lands across our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's put Americans to work on jobs that really need to be done, building national assets for future generations. For information on the CCC idea, go to wecantakeit.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
And now, a look at stories on media reform from Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. After a five-year struggle against Bell South and Cox Cable, the town of Lafayette, Louisiana, began offering its new fiber-optic broadband service last week. The project, which is expected to be completed by 2011, will be the biggest publicly owned fiber network in the country. Attorney Jim Baller got involved in the fight for community internet in Lafayette in 2005 when Bell South pressured the Louisiana State Legislature to block the project. The proposed law would have imposed a series of obstacles preventing the community from offering internet service that competed with the phone and cable companies. Then-Governor Kathleen Blanco all but locked Baller in a room with Bell South and Cox until they came up with a compromise.
The way we negotiated was to take each and every one of the provisions, line by line, go through it, and say, this can't work. What are you doing, Bell South and Cox? Are you complying with anything like this yourself? And provision after provision, they responded that no, they weren't.
Even after the compromise, Bell South, now known as AT&T, continued to fight against the Lafayette project.
Bell South had a lapse of memory as to what it had agreed to in the bill, and it started a series of lawsuits that ended up tying up Lafayette in litigation over the course of the next two and a half years. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of Louisiana resolved the issue unanimously in Lafayette's favor, clearing the project to move forward.
Lafayette Fiber Broadband Services will be faster and cheaper than the competition. With speeds ranging from 10 to 50 megabits per second, the 30 megabit per second tier costs $45. AT&T offers a maximum of 6 megabits per second for $43. The basic video tier includes 19 channels and costs $17. Customers are already subscribing to phone, television, and internet services through Lafayette Fiber.
Are corporate marketers preying on kids for profit? According to a new film, advertisers want to create consumers for life, and they're branding every aspect of childhood, from TV, toys, internet games and DVDs, to clothes and food. They're also encouraging children to sit in front of screens for several hours a day, with little regard for children's mental or physical health. Adriana Barbaro, producer of Consuming Kids, The Commercialization of Childhood, says the media may pose many health risks for children.
Some studies suggest that heavy television watching changes the way that the brain develops, and it's affecting children's ability to learn and leading to attention problems such as ADD and ADHD. There are many studies linking children's exposure to violence, to violent and aggressive behavior, and to anxiety and depression and to sleep problems in children.
Studies also show that marketing of junk food to children is escalating, and it's led to an epidemic of obesity in children.
So for the first time in modern times, children's life expectancies that are born today are shorter than that of their parents.
Aside from physical and mental health risks, she says, there is also a larger effect on society.
It's the values that kids are learning. There's the message that kids are getting over and over again at earlier and earlier ages is that it's about me. It's about me now, instant gratification, material values in the sense that what you are and what you own and what you buy defines you. So it's really a disservice to kids because we're teaching them to look outside of themselves for happiness and satisfaction. And so they're always going to be chasing after the next, you know, greatest and latest.
Barbaro says that everyone must get involved to change marketing practices to children.
So many parents, just from the research I've done, are seeing changes in their kids. And a lot of times they're not linking it and don't recognize that what kids are putting in their body in terms of their media diet is just as important as the food they're getting in their body and the exercise or whatever else that they're doing, that your media diet has an effect on you. There's a connection. And if you're concerned with the junk food or if you're concerned with the precocious sexuality or the violence in the media, that it's one industry selling all these things to your kids. They're undermining your job. They're making your job as a parent, which is already so hard, harder. As a community, we need to support parents, and we really need to support our children. They deserve better.
For more information about Consuming Kids, visit the Media Education Foundation at mediaed.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
After repeated calls from the KBOO Evening News and other community media outlets, the Iowa National Guard has announced that they have changed their plan to train in urban warfare in a small Iowa town. The Guard had originally planned to conduct a massive training exercise in the town of Arcata, Iowa, in which troops would knock on doors and search homes of willing residents. Now, according to the Iowa National Guard spokesman, the training will take place inside the local armory and will not include any direct interfacing with local residents. The spokesman told KBOO that they decided to change the exercise because they simply didn't have the capacity to conduct the wide-scale exercise they had originally planned. He said that the decision was not made because of public pressure or constitutional concerns about the use of the National Guard as police.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine and from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, February 24, 2009. The Israeli army kidnaps civilians from the West Bank and attacks a local media agency. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two civilians were kidnapped by the Israeli army as it invaded the northern West Bank city of Nablus on Tuesday and searched homes, a local TV station and a school there. Local sources said that at least 30 military vehicles stormed the city and searched homes and local shops. Later, troops took over a building in the city. The building hosts Asia TV station, a local TV station in Nablus. According to the employees of the TV, soldiers forced them to a room and kept them there until they left. They added that soldiers used the studio as a military post during the pre-dawn invasion. Witnesses said that soldiers also attacked the school and searched it, as well as nearby homes, and caused damage. The military left the city early in the morning after kidnapping two civilians. Elsewhere, five Palestinian civilians were kidnapped by the Israeli military during pre-dawn home searches targeting the southern West Bank city of Hebron and nearby villages on Tuesday. Local sources said that Israeli troops attacked and searched homes in Hebron Old City Part in the nearby Sa'ir and Nivna villages. Witnesses said that Israeli soldiers searched their homes and damaged their belongings during the search. Moreover, two Palestinian teens were kidnapped on Tuesday by Israeli forces that invaded the village of Jayus, located near the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya. Internally, as both rival Fatah and Hamas officials agree to meet in Egypt for internal dialogue, a Palestinian security source announced that the Palestinian security forces have released 30 Hamas members on Tuesday midday. The 30 were released in several West Bank cities. The sources added that all of them were Hamas members and they were arrested several weeks ago and some of them have served several months. But both Hamas and Fatah accuses each other of holding hundreds of supporters. A call for unity was issued by over 500 personalities from all factions in Palestine. Thank you for joining us. From occupied Bethlehem, you have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Barnoura and Samer Jabir.
The results of a major Mexican military offensive indicate an unprecedented number of drug and arms seizures and a record number of high-ranking drug lord detentions. Dubbed Operation Tijuana, the strategy seeks to eliminate the drug trade in Mexico's northern border with the United States. But now, 2 years after its implementation, violent murders are at a record high, journalists are being intimidated by authorities, and human rights abuses are getting harder and harder to document. FSRN's Victoria Martinez brings this special report from Tijuana.
If publicity and numbers are everyday indicators, Operation Tijuana is a big success. The number of drug and gun seizures have gone up, but so do the figures of violence. According to recent statistics released by the Federal Public Safety Office, over 6,000 people were killed in Mexico in the drug-related violence in 2008. And the state of Baja California alone had over 1,000 drug-related murders, of which 80% took place in Tijuana, border city to San Diego. San Diego State University professor and Binational Human Rights Center director Victor Clark Alfaro considers this strategy a big failure.
The activity of the organized crime have developed in the same trend that in the past, even there is more violence. And not even the militaries, probably you think that because the militaries arrived in large numbers by the beginning of 2007, the violence has reached new dimensions and new levels.
The forces work with impunity and little respect for human rights. In a gruesome incident, sundown January 6, 2009, a group of federal police went into the Tijuana riverbed, where an estimated 500 people live, many of them homeless due to drug addiction. A photojournalist who asked his name be withheld was near the sewage pipes when he heard gunshots and went to investigate. What he found, there was three federal agents torturing two men they had just detained. the journalist witnessed and photographed the agents ordering the detainees to take their clothes off, kicking the clothes out of their reach and then sinking their heads under the cold sewage water with their military boots. I spoke to the photojournalist.
And then they took the second guy, the guy who was on the floor, and they threw him with the other guy. They took the two of them and started hitting them and pushing their heads under the sewage water. By then, I had already hid behind the bushes.
The pictures he took were sensational and published in the front page of Frontera newspaper without a byline for fear of reprisals. Not long ago, a Telemundo reporter and camera person were illegally detained and intimidated by federal police. Midday December 25th, Claudia Orozco and her rookie cameraman were inside their station car when they were surrounded by 20 federal agents, all of them with their face covered by black masks and their guns in the air. Orozco did not obey their orders to give over the camera and their phones, so the agents came aboard the car and ordered them to drive to the hotel where federal forces are stationed.
They came in and sat in the back seat of our truck and said, "Bring them in, you are under arrest." And I said, "On what grounds?" "For disrespecting authority."
Por desacato a la autoridad.
But they were not taken to a police station or a courthouse for a formal sanction.
That's when I realized their so-called detention meant they were taking us to the hotel where they were staying.
After being questioned at the hotel for 20 minutes and with the pressure of the media posted outside the hotel, the journalists were released. Orozco got a call soon after by the head of the federal police, who apologized for the incident and promised an investigation. But the police was not available to speak to Free Speech Radio News on any of these incidents. Dr. Clark Alfaro claims this increased violence and mutual distrust between civilians and authorities are not only making it harder for journalists, but also for human rights activists like him, who had an easier time documenting abuses in the past.
Nowadays, it's very difficult to document it, because in many of the cases where people was victim, in many of those cases, they were killed. Why? Because in many of the bodies that are found in our city, in some of those victims, the police participate torturing and then, together with the organized crime, killing these people, so you cannot document those cases.
Mexican President Felipe Calderón has made it clear that federal force involvement in the war against drug trafficking is here to stay. Congress is currently debating legislation that would broaden the faculties of phone espionage and new mechanisms to speeding up the process of arrests and search warrants. But the legislators aren't debating an inclusion of any anti-corruption measures or to hold the force accountable on abuses of human rights or press freedom. From Tijuana, Mexico, this is Victoria Martinez for Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Morgan Rich, Dane Gatewood, and Kyle Burris. Our engineer is Kyle Burris. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KABU website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Locus Focus Talk Radio, investigative journalist and author Protop Chatterjee talks about the privatized outsourced military that Barack Obama has inherited from the Bush administration. At 9 it's Movie Talk with Don, Doug, and Ed. At 9:30, Web of Life features a call-in program with local animals. With a local animal communicator, Bridget, on how to talk with your pet or other animals. At 10 on Alternative Radio, host David Barsamian interviews Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States. The topic is Against Discouragement. At 11, listen to Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And 11:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at noon, for listen in for a special program for the 15th anniversary of the Hebron Massacre, in which 29 Palestinians praying in a mosque were gunned down by an Israeli settler. And now, stay tuned for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Linda.
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 24th of February, 2009. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testifies before the Senate and rejects the idea of bank nationalization. The New York City Council examines the effects of their state's harsh drug laws. And we'll hear about an Egyptian-sponsored attempt to reconcile the differences between Hamas and Fatah. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down three decisions today. The justices upheld the conviction of a West Virginia man charged under a federal ban on firearms possession by anyone previously convicted of domestic violence. In the second decision, the court dealt a blow to Native American tribes seeking self-governance on their lands. The Narragansett tribe sought relief from Rhode Island state law, but was denied because they were not yet federally recognized when the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 was passed. And labor lost in the final matter. The high court ruled that an Idaho law banning payroll deductions for union dues and political activities is constitutional. The AFL-CIO, along with five labor unions, unsuccessfully argued that the deductions were protected under the First Amendment. In South Africa, thousands of workers are losing jobs in the country's mining sector. UK-based mining firm Lonmin announced today that it's cutting 5,500 posts. Davison Makanga reports.
Lonmin joined several other African mining companies in either downsizing operations or closing down entirely. Last week, mining giant Anglo American said it would cut more than 19,000 jobs. Locally owned Africa Resource Minerals, or ARM, will cut thousands of contractor jobs and shed hundreds of permanent positions. ARM will also cut capital spending due to falling platinum demand in light of the tight credit market conditions and the battered automotive industry in the U.S. The Confederation of South African Trade Unions says recent developments are sad for workers, many of whom have little means to survive. South Africa is a major platinum and gold exporter, but production is drastically slowed. The nation's gross domestic product has fallen by 1.8% in the last 3 months. For FSRN, this is Jefferson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
Tibetans mark the new year tomorrow, but they will not be joined by foreign tourists this year. According to travel industry workers in the region, China has closed the area to outsiders until the end of March. China says that applications for travel permits are being accepted, but has not indicated if they are being approved. This March marks the 50th anniversary of the unsuccessful uprising against Chinese rule and the escape and exile of the Dalai Lama. Last year, riots broke out after 4 days of peaceful protest marking the date. Human rights organizations say thousands of people were rounded up, some 200 were killed, and several hundred remain missing. China says at least 18 died. President Obama welcomed Japan's Prime Minister Taro Aso to the White House today. Free Speech Radio News' Jason Strother reports from Tokyo.
Taro Aso's visit to Washington is largely symbolic. Analysts here say it's not much more than a goodwill gesture by the Obama administration aimed at showing the Japanese people that the U.S. values its relationship with their nation. Symbolic or not, there are plenty of real issues concerning the Japan-U.S. alliance. Tokyo has agreed to fund many reconstruction projects in Afghanistan, including paying the salaries of 80,000 Afghan police officers. The U.S. and Japan are worried about North Korea's announcement today that it is preparing to launch a satellite into orbit, which is feared to be, in fact, a rocket system capable of firing long-range missiles. But it seems likely that Prime Minister Ah Soo's first visit to the White House will also be his last. His approval rating here is hovering around 10%. His party seems poised to lose upcoming parliamentary elections. Masaru Nishikawa, research fellow at the Japan Institute for International Affairs, says everyone, including Ah Soo and Obama, see the writing on the wall.
From my point of view, I think in Washington, is they're predicting the regime change of Japanese government in near future. That's, you know, probably obvious.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Tokyo.
Residents of the District of Columbia came a giant step closer to being represented in the U.S. Congress today. Democrats found enough votes in the Senate to guarantee the D.C. House Voting Rights Bill will not be blocked by Republican opposition and will be debated. The measure would add two seats to the House of Representatives. One seat would go to largely liberal D.C., the other to conservative Utah. A vote in the Senate could come in the next few days, but Republicans plan to offer amendments that could derail the legislation. Tomorrow, the bill is expected to go to the House. If approved by both chambers, it moves on to President Obama, who co-sponsored the measure when he was in the Senate. And the Mexico Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has condemned the assassination of two prominent indigenous activists and is concerned about the safety of other human rights defenders in the resource-rich region. Shannon Young has more.
State investigators found the remains of Raul Lucas and Manuel Ponce in plastic bags inside a shallow grave over the weekend. The bodies of both men bore the signs of torture. They had been missing since February 13th, when men who identified themselves as police removed them from a public meeting in Guerrero State. The two men led a group known as the Organization for the Future of the Mixtec People, active in one of the poorest areas of the country. The region is home to rich ancient forests that have been steadily depleted by illegal logging of precious hardwood trees, despite protests by local indigenous campesinos. Numerous activists with ties to forest defense efforts have been either killed or imprisoned on questionable charges in Guerrero over the past decade. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Testifying before the Senate, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke backtracked from the possibility of bank nationalization, dismissing the idea that the government might need to take over some banks, but that doesn't remove nationalization as an option moving forward. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell explains what the process might mean for U.S. taxpayers.
The word nationalization, as it refers to U.S. banks, has been discussed recently in the media and in the financial industry. In an about-face, former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan says it should be considered. So did Republican Senator of South Carolina Lindsey Graham. But no current member of the administration has publicly used that word, nationalization. Testifying before the Senate Banking Committee, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke again distanced the government from that position, even when pressed by Republican Bob Corker of Tennessee.
I'd like for you to give me a term to use as I leave here as to what we would call that.
Call it a public-private partnership.
It's not nationalization because the banks would not be wholly owned or probably not even majority owned by the government. The government will be a shareholder along with private shareholders.
But you're putting in a mechanism to where our common equity holdings will be large by virtue of creating this convertible preferred situation.
Okay, stop tape. Convertible preferred what? Let's take it back a few steps, back to the basics. First, what is bank nationalization? FSRN asked Thomas Ferguson, professor of economics at University of Massachusetts, for some assistance.
So there's lots of ways you can do this. All of them end up with the government owning the stock.
Okay, easy enough. The government owns the bank's stock. Now let's go back to that clip where Chair Bernanke and Senator Corker are talking. The thing to listen for are the words convertible and preferred.
It's not nationalization because the banks would not be wholly owned or probably not even majority owned by the government. The government will be a shareholder along with private shareholders.
But you're putting in a mechanism to where our common equity holdings will be large by virtue of creating this convertible preferred situation.
Preferred stocks are rated higher and have higher priority than common stocks, but owners do not have voting power at shareholder meetings. The U.S. government, under the $700 billion bailout, is buying preferred stocks. The government's plan would be to convert those preferred stocks to common stocks. The U.S. would then buy up the common stocks, so the U.S. now has voting power, or say, in how the bank is run. In other words, nationalization. With control of the banks, the government would have the ability to get rid of so-called bad assets. Thomas Ferguson explains.
Imagine you take the bank and you divide it into two, the good bank and the bad bank, rather like one of those Daffy Duck cartoons. You know, I mean, the word that's usually angels and Daffy's got a split personality.
The good assets are moved to one bank. The bad assets are moved to another, which keeps the bad assets from dragging down the whole ship.
You then put new money into it. You recapitalize it. It can go back to being a bank. It can make new loans.
Proponents of nationalization say the cost of buying up these bad assets is far less than continuing to give capital to the banks, which is what the government is currently doing. They also say the taxpayers could benefit.
Big deal for the taxpayers in this is that you can actually sell these things that your money has fixed up. You can get the money back.
The direct losers in this situation? Executives and stockholders. That's because their stocks are diluted if the government comes in. Currently, they have incentive to maintain control, with the hope that their stock prices will eventually rise. Bank nationalization is an idea that's not being talked about by the government, but is being considered for Citigroup and Bank of America. Bernanke says, not in so many words, that the 20 largest institutions will have to open their books and be examined by the government to determine if nationalization is in their future. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Congressional Hispanic Caucus members are touring around the country, hearing about the ways that families and communities have been affected by what they say is a broken immigration system. Although President Obama campaigned on a promise to work on immigration reform, it's unclear whether new legislation will actually work its way to a vote this year on Capitol Hill. FSRN's Peter Granitz has more.
Members of the Hispanic Caucus will partner with faith leaders across the country to hold town hall forums on immigration. Members of the group hope it will educate both immigrants and non-immigrants alike about the need for comprehensive immigration reform. Nedia Velasquez chairs the caucus. She's requested a meeting with the president and wants to start working.
Earlier than later, because once we start into midterm election, it's going to be more difficult.
The New York Democrat recognizes that her group's wishes may not exactly coincide with congressional leaders, though, even those in her own party.
We are talking to everyone, including the Democratic leadership, and I hope that they realize that for immigrants in this country and for Latinos in this country, this is a political defining issue.
Velasquez expects President Obama to address immigration in Tuesday night's speech before Congress. One thing is certain to her. Immigrants want to see reform. She says many Latinos voted in last fall's elections, and their number one concern isn't the economy, it's immigration. Immigration was a key issue for Senator John McCain, who partnered with Senator Ted Kennedy on immigration reform in 2006. But now he's deferring to the man who beat him to the Oval Office.
The unions had a very big role to play in President Obama's election, and they're against a temporary worker program. It's got to be comprehensive, so the initiative has got to come from the president.
McCain didn't indicate when or if Congress will take up the issue.
No one's talking about it much right now.
That's Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. She's one of the president's closest confidants from his days in the Senate.
I think everyone is so focused right now on the economic crisis, and then health care is so big, and energy. I don't know. I think a lot of it depends on the president.
Paco Fabian works for America's Voice, a D.C.-based advocacy group. He says don't expect to hear anything on immigration tonight, but he said all signs point to quick reform.
Senator Harry Reid has placed a placeholder bill
for immigration reform in the top 10 bills that the Senate wants to deal with this year. We've seen the appointment of Jenna Napolitano as Secretary of Homeland Security, a border state governor who really understands the need for comprehensive immigration reform.
He says a bill should reform border security, create a path to citizenship, albeit with penalties and fines, and create a temporary guest worker program. He says the legislation could be in motion by this fall. Fabian says if Republicans want to woo immigrants, and specifically Latino immigrant voters, they'll need to change their tone. Otherwise, he says, the GOP risks becoming a regional party for decades. Republican Senator John Cornyn represents Texas, the state that shares the largest stretch of the Mexican border. He says reform is both a Republican priority and a personal priority.
I'm considering offering legislation, but the fact of the matter is that we're in a minority. It's really all up to the Democratic leadership.
Some Democrats recognize the political sensitivity that accompanies immigration reform debate, including New York's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. He served as chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee before and chairs the subcommittee on border issues, immigration, and citizenship.
We need something to be done. System's broken now.
Can
you bring anything up?
We'll see.
Senator Mel Martinez of Florida could prove to be the bipartisan gap in the next 2 years. The Republican admits he's in a prime position on the issue. He's a Latino and retiring at the end of his current term.
I would be prepared to engage in a very proactive effort to see a comprehensive bill go forward.
Does Martinez think the president will address the issue tonight?
I hope so. I hope so. I think he needs to.
Citizens will find out soon whether the president agrees. He's set to address Congress at 9 o'clock East Coast time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Peter Granitz in Washington.
FSRN has reported on the ways in which Iraq war contractors have profited as a result of waste, corruption, and fraud. And today, we're going to explore another angle of the military's use of contractors. Pratap Chatterjee is the author of Halliburton's Army and the managing editor of Corp Watch, and he's cautioning that we might be missing the entire picture of contractors abroad. Chatterjee finds that Halliburton might just be guilty of changing the way the U.S. makes war.
Well, one of the things I found out about investigating Halliburton is the left is almost entirely wrong about Halliburton. I think the left has been very critical of the fact that they believe that Dick Cheney has given the contracts to Halliburton. The company has, you know, wasted a lot of money. They have profiteered. They've provided bad water, bad food, et cetera, et cetera. And the soldiers, you know, and the taxpayers are getting ripped off. I found almost exactly the opposite in my investigations. In traveling to Iraq, embedding with the military, I've been seduced, as some people say on the left, by the military's vision. And it's actually been very interesting, because what I found in going to Iraq is that actually the reason Halliburton's army of 50,000 people are involved in the war is really to make this transition from what was a draft army in Vietnam to what is now a volunteer army. In order to be able to get soldiers to go to Iraq today, you cannot expect them to peel potatoes, clean toilets, build buildings, and live in the desert in horrible conditions for 4 years. You have to actually provide them with the amenities of home. You have to provide them with the kind of lifestyle that we expect in the 21st century, which is a Walmart, a McDonald's, you know, an Xbox and that sort of thing. And what KBR's role here is providing those amenities to American soldiers. So today there are 50,000 workers in Halliburton's army, largely drawn from the Third World, people from India, Sri Lanka, former Soviet Republic of Georgia, from Fiji, from Pakistan, the Philippines. And their job, working at $300 a month, is to cook and clean for the soldiers. So Americans can go to war on full stomachs. Napoleon once said, an army marches on its stomach. And in order to be able to get the army into place in Iraq or anywhere else, you need to be able to provide for it. And particularly if you have a volunteer army, it's not possible to expect them to do things that they wouldn't normally want to do or risk their lives unless somebody provides them the 21st century environment that they enjoy. And really, even though the company has taken advantage of it and they have wasted money, their role is actually far more sophisticated. It is in order to ensure that a small number of American soldiers will go to Iraq and participate in a war that, let's say, the average person in America would not take part in.
I want to go back to this question of waste. Earlier this month, a report released by the Special Inspector for Iraq Reconstruction found massive waste and fraud, I think to the tune of nearly $1 trillion.
Okay, well, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, led by Stuart Boeing, has studied a number of contracts in the reconstruction of Iraq, and to a certain extent, some contracts related to KBR and Halliburton. The amount of money that was spent was $125 billion. What they found was mostly waste. They found a little amount of fraud and corruption. And some of these are structural. The U.S. hired companies such as Parsons from Pasadena here in Southern California, Bechtel in San Francisco, and sent them to Iraq to do jobs that they then subcontracted to local companies. And so what happened was you end up paying top dollar for American companies to work in Iraq, which then subcontracted and paid local wages to people over there. So a lot of money was wasted, particularly in this pyramid of contracting. Work didn't get done, money was wasted. Today, the U.S. military has actually realized it's a very bad idea to hire American contractors to do that. So if you go to Iraq today, and in fact, I'm working with a researcher who called me yesterday from Baghdad, there are no American contractors left. The U.S. military has switched entirely the Army Corps of Engineers from using American contractors to using Iraqi contractors because it puts more money into the economy. It means it's more likely to get finished because they're not trying to not use American engineering standards, American security standards that actually attract attention and attacks and things like that.
Pratap Chatterjee is the author of Halliburton's Army and the managing editor of Corp Watch. New York State's Rockefeller drug laws call for lengthy mandatory minimum sentences for even nonviolent offenses, laws that prison reform advocates say are some of the most draconian in the nation. The New York City Council is now examining the law's effects, and at a hearing today, former state lawmaker G. Oliver Koppel, who voted against the measures in 1973, reiterated his opposition to them. Koppel says the Rockefeller drug laws have resulted in overcrowded prisons and have failed to bring down drug ringleaders. As Ari Paul reports, with a change in control of the state legislature and the need to cut state spending, there are some signs for change.
Terrence Stevens doesn't look like a threat to public safety. Virtually paralyzed from the neck down due to muscular dystrophy, Stevens was traveling to Buffalo on a bus with a friend in 1992. He hadn't known that his companion had 5 ounces of cocaine in his luggage. Arrested along with his friend during a drug bust, he was convicted and received the mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years. Stevens learned in Greenhaven State Penitentiary that the state's prisons were not well designed for people with his disability.
Throughout my incarceration, I had to be bathed, fed, assisted with wheelchair movement. I had to be turned over from side to side every 2 hours during the night to ease respiratory complications.
Deteriorating conditions combined with a lack of wheelchair accessibility caused Stevens to have a number of physical accidents with lasting consequences.
As a result, I suffered a compressed lung, loss of movement in my right hand, and my back severely curves to the left.
Stevens received executive clemency in 2000. He lost a decade of his life because New York state law requires that most drug offenders be sentenced to at least 15 years in prison. In 1973, Governor Nelson Rockefeller enacted the harsh codes for small-time offenders with the stated intent of bringing down drug kingpins. But according to the Drug Policy Alliance, 14,000 people currently serve in state prisons under the drug laws, many of them, like Stevens, on nonviolent offenses. This year, Governor David Patterson and Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver have vowed sweeping reform of the drug laws. The Democrats took control of the state Senate in November, giving the party full control of Albany. And with the state looking to cut spending to close a massive budget shortfall, reform groups believe the time is right for change. Glenn Martin is the Vice President of Development and Public Affairs at the David Rothenberg Center for Public Policy in New York City. He noted that more than 80% of people jailed on the state's drug laws are Black or Latino.
We don't go into J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs to do drug busts. We do them on corners, and poor people tend to sell drugs on corners. The other thing is that the statute calls for significant time for people caught with crack cocaine, whereas a person caught with powdered cocaine may end up with a probation sentence.
Others say the laws create a dangerous situation for cops. Anthony Miranda is executive chairman of the National Latino Officers Association of America. He says not only have the laws failed to bring down so-called drug kingpins, but nonviolent offenders are more likely to react violently to police if they fear that they automatically face a lengthy sentence.
If they believe that they can go to court and defend themselves and have a fair trial, it'll cut down on the confrontations
and the assaults that police officers will have to encounter when making those arrests.
Stevens says that since the Rockefeller laws target minorities in low-income communities, high incarceration rates compound social problems for the thousands of children in these communities.
They suffer from abandonment. They suffer low self-esteem. These children need tutoring. A lot of the families are too poor to transport children up to correctional facilities to visit their fathers who's locked up and their mothers who's locked up.
In addition to a shifting attitude in the state capitol, Martin pointed out that there are signs that the judicial system itself is cognizant of the law's problems.
Prosecutors have found a way to divert some folks into treatment, which to me is a clear statement that treatment works and that everyone should not go to prison.
With the New York state budget crisis causing public service cutbacks and higher taxes, reform advocates believe that citizens will push for new drug laws that will result in less spending on corrections. In New York, this is Ari Paul for FSRN.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org.
Representatives from rival Palestinian parties Hamas and Fatah are set to travel to Cairo for reconciliation talks aimed at ending the divisions between the occupied territories of Gaza and the West Bank. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
One day before their representatives head for Cairo to try to end differences, Hamas and Fatah traded blame for attempts to foil a national conciliation. Monday, Hamas in Gaza released video footage of suspected Fatah-allied security members confessing they disseminated information on Hamas's whereabouts during the recent Israeli attacks on the Hamas-ruled Gaza. Ismail Erdogan is a spokesperson for Hamas in Gaza.
Success of such a dialogue depends primarily on whether or not Fatah actually implements what they have agreed to do, to release political detainees in the West Bank and halt incriminating media campaigns. We heard a new rhetoric, but this rhetoric needs to be put into practice. Tomorrow, there will be a bilateral meeting between the two delegations to sort out obstacles, and we are hopeful about getting through these obstacles and preparing the atmosphere for the Palestinian dialogue.
In the West Bank, Fatah considered the Hamas accusations merely false, casting doubts over success of the upcoming Cairo conference. Mohib Salama is a spokesperson for Fatah in the West Bank.
I believe that there has been an agreement to form a committee to discuss these Hamas prisoners, that some of the detainees were actually released, and the PA and President Abu Mazen intend to release all those who have not been charged with crimes. But the footage yesterday showed Fatah members alleging that some security officers collaborate with the occupation, and it made us question Hamas' dedication to making this dialogue succeed.
Fatah-Hamas rivalry has deepened after Hamas took over Gaza and ejected Fatah-allied forces from the territory in June 2007. The two parties have failed to form a unity government that could end an Israeli blockade and an internationally enforced embargo. Meanwhile, Hamas did not confirm Israeli media reports that a prisoner swap deal with Israel via Egyptian mediators was being negotiated. Last week, Cairo postponed the National Unity Conference due to lack of ceasefire in Gaza. Israeli officials said they would not stop attacks until Hamas released a captured Israeli soldier. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almighari in Gaza.
And And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We're supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by dropping us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
The rule of law. Since the Magna Carta, the idea that the will of the rulers can be bound by law seemed like a pretty good one. On Thursday, February 26th, at 6 p.m., we the people will address war crimes and impunity. Should the Bush administration be held accountable for possible war crimes? What are the obligations of the Obama administration to restore the rule of law? Join us for a call-in show where we'll explore these questions. We'll also have an interview with Chuck Sudetic, co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confronting Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity, and Francis Boyle, University of Illinois law professor and internationally recognized expert on international law and human rights. Call us with your questions or comments, or post them before and after the show at www.kboo.fm/we the people. Just because the president does it, it doesn't mean it's not illegal.
On Wednesday, February 25th, from noon to 6 p.m., KBOO presents The Hebron Massacre, 15 years later. On February 25th, 1994, 29 Palestinians praying in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron were gunned down by Zionist extremist Baruch Goldstein. 3 months later, the first Palestinian suicide bombing took place. We'll look at the significance of the Hebron Massacre during a six-hour special on February 25th from noon to 6 p.m. on KBOO. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
The time is 6:03 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Out Loud.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. For more information, you can call 503-230-7701, or you can visit them on the web at www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
Welcome to Out Loud, KBOO's queer news and public affairs show. My name is Carla. I'll be your host for the show this evening. Tonight we've got quite an exciting lineup. The first half of the show, we're going to hear some live music from a local group named Felina's Arrow. And then at 6:30, we're going to move into a discussion and interview with some of the organizers and some presenters from the LGBTQ Meaningful Care Conference, which is going to be happening on Friday, March 13th, and the Meaningful Care Conference is a best practices conference for medical and social service providers around appropriate health care and social services for the queer community. Again, we'll be hearing from them at 6:30. But to start the show with, I'd like to remind our listeners that this is your only source of locally produced queer radio on your radio dial. And in April, we'll be celebrating 8 years on the radio. And we'd like to hear hear your suggestions. What do you want to hear on your Homo Radio Hour in the eighth year? We are always looking for suggestions and ideas for future radio shows, and you can send me your ideas or input at outloudradio@gmail.com. And again, look for some special programming in April as we celebrate our eight-year birthday. And next, I'd like to go ahead and move into some music. First, let's have some discussion. Before we get to the music, I'd like to say welcome to Out Loud to the ladies of Felina's Arrow.
Thank you for having us.
We've got three musicians here in the studio. I'd like to introduce Sarah and Poena and Felicia.
Bueno.
Hello.
Hello. Sarah is the percussionist. And the other two ladies play a variety of instruments, but maybe Poena, go ahead and tell us, how would you describe your music for our listeners that aren't familiar with you?
Well, we've been compared as a blend of Bjork and Ella Fitzgerald before, and I don't know, we're pretty theatrical, and we really like harmony, but we're also pretty experimental, too. We like to put on really fun shows that incorporate a lot of different types of talent. And so the next show that we have coming up, we are actually going to be having the sax quartet, the Quadrophones, and we're also going to have a harpist, and we have some backup singers and a cellist and all kinds of other fun
Adam
musicians.
Hirsch, the cellist.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. When's that going to happen?
March 5th at the Hawthorne Theater.
And for folks that don't know where the Hawthorne Theater is, where it's on Hawthorne, but where?
39th and Hawthorne.
Okay.
The building with the flames.
The buildings with the flames. Okay, on the corner of 39th and Hawthorne. And I think you also have a gig you're playing as part of another lineup this coming week, correct? Or in a couple of days?
Yeah, it's going to be a really, really fun show. The Madonna-thon.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's a benefit for Another Words Bookstore, and it's going to be a lot of different bands from Portland that are all going to be performing Madonna covers.
And this is the Madonna-thon is an all-ages show.
Yes, it is.
And again, for those that aren't familiar, all these different musicians are going to be playing Madonna songs. And I read something that there's going to be a costume contest.
Yes, there is. So come decked out in your favorite Madonna attire.
We hope that the whole audience and all the performers, that everybody will look like Madonna, and it will just get out of hand.
And there's three decades of Madonna that you can choose from. She's been around a while rocking it.
You could be the boy toy. You could be there's so many different incarnations.
Uh-huh.
Very
the
nice.
The leather Madonna.
Nice.
The Vogue Madonna.
And, again, now we're talking the Madonna-thon. It is an $8 cover charge, but all the money is going to In Other Words, which is the local feminist nonprofit bookstore. It's actually the last feminist nonprofit bookstore in the country. For those that don't know, it's located on North Killingsworth at North Williams. This is all going to be happening, the Madonna-thon happening Thursday, this coming Thursday, at the Hollywood Theater. The address is 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. I think the doors open at 6, and then the music starts at 7. And there's more than 10 different acts that are going to be performing.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are going to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you gals are going to be one of them. Awesome. Well, how about let's give our listeners a little sample of your music.
All right. Sounds good.
What song do you want to play first?
This song is called Natural Disaster, and it's was inspired by our lovely friend Zanny. We were having a discussion about how, I don't know, it had something to do with, we had heard there was, you know, this natural disaster had occurred and all these people were getting some money from Red Cross or something, and we were sitting there talking about how we were going to pay rent, and she, you know, I had said something to the effect of like, well, I'm a natural disaster, I could use some money, and she started laughing so hard we decided to put it into a song.
I always say that you're really, really unpredictable. I've never have any idea how, this is Felicia talking about Poena. she acts so randomly, so well, the song the song is, it's not a bad thing, it's very entertaining.
All right, so for our listeners, we're going to hear a live song from local group Felina's Arrow, and this song is titled Natural Disaster.
Troublemaker.
disaster picture, but I won't sink but swim.
That was Natural Disaster by local group Felina's Arrow, and we were hearing that was vocals mostly from Poena. But I noticed that you all have some different instruments, so I guess let's talk a little bit how your music comes together, because I know you all play a lot of different instruments. Mm-hmm. So on any given show, we'll be hearing guitar, bass, and you have a harp that's going to be playing with you this next week.
Saxophones, cello, backup singers,
percussion.
Just whatever we feel like. We just like to extend our creativity and just to whatever fancies us at the moment.
And we're meeting a lot of really wonderful musicians who are willing to come and play with us, which is so much fun.
Mm-hmm. So. I really like it when people do what they like to do, and so if we can put together a show where everybody gets to do only what they like to do, then it just makes it a lot of fun.
Nice, very nice. And when you guys compose your music, I know you play mostly original stuff. Mm-hmm. Do the lyrics usually come first, or is it more the music or the melody comes first? How does that work for you guys?
Multiple ways.
Yeah, we get that question a lot, and I don't know, I think that every song is different. Like, there's definitely songs that just kind of write themselves in a way that is a little creepy because you feel like, well, maybe you didn't really write the song, maybe you just heard it somewhere. And it just kind of comes together, but, you know, other times the words come first and other times the music comes first, and so it really just depends. Sometimes I'll start writing a song and sometimes Felicia will start writing a song, and then sometimes we just completely write together and see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. All right. How long have you two been collaborating?
6 years, I believe. Or are we going on 7 years?
Going on 7.
Pretty much since the day we met.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yeah. Do you want to share that story? I know it's a nice story for those that don't know.
Aww.
Shucks. It's kind of a love story, but it's also a music story.
Well, I was really rude.
You want to tell that version?
That was Poena.
Well, we don't have to tell him. We can pretend that I'm always perfect and nice.
Well, you basically ran into each other somewhere. I was traveling around the country in my van again. This is Felicia, and with me and my dog, Tobin. And I was in Seattle playing on the sidewalk for gas money to get to Portland, which I'd never been to before. And Polina walked by with her guitar, and I hadn't seen...
Pink cowboy hat.
Yeah, pink cowgirl hat.
However you like
pink
it.
Fuzzy cowgirl hat. Anyways, I just stopped her and asked her, you know, play me a song. I hadn't seen very many women musicians. And so I asked her to play me a song, and she told me that, well, I'll be playing a set down on the corner in like half an hour if you want to see me. So I was like, okay. I didn't go. But the next day, I was about to leave town. Someone had told me they'll pay for my gas to get to Portland if I drove him down, because I'd rather ride with me than on the Greyhound. So I told him, no problem. He went to go cancel his Greyhound ticket, and Polina walked by again.
You know, it's not totally just, you know, I wasn't trying to be rude or pretentious. It's just that I used to play on the sidewalk a lot. That's just, like, that's how I used to feed myself, because I've been taking care of myself since I was 15. And when you're that young, you can't really, you know, get jobs because of laws and things. So, you know, you have a choice of, like, singing on the sidewalk or being a drug dealer. And so I thought maybe I'll just sing on the sidewalk. And so I just was so used to people coming up to me and saying, play me a song, or, like, trying to take my guitar, or trying to, you know, just kind of just a lot of harassment.
Yeah.
So, like, I just got into the habit of not being very nice to people when they talk to me, so.
I asked her, she walked by again, and...
disclaimer.
Well, I saw her walk by again, and it was just like, I looked at her, you know, play me a song. So she looked at me and goes, okay, and she opened up her guitar case and got out her guitar and started playing and singing, and I was just totally awestruck, and I couldn't even breathe. And I opened up my van as fast as I could and got out my guitar and started playing along with her, and we just played the whole entire afternoon and made a lot of money.
I never heard anybody play the way she played, and so... And then all my friends were like, oh, who's this girl you're madly in love with? I was like, I'm not in love. I just don't want to spend a single second away from her ever again in my life. In love, is that love?
And here we are today.
Yep.
So cheesy.
So the guy came back, and I told him, well, actually, I guess I'm not leaving town anymore. And, yeah, so stayed in Seattle for a while, and then we traveled around in the van and...
And here we are.
Here we are, roundabout.
Hey, Sarah.
A beautiful... Oh, yeah, Sarah's veto on the love story here. Beautiful love story. Beautiful music. Awesome, awesome story. Thank you for sharing the story. How about another song? I guess your beautiful love story has led to so much beautiful music. Though, let's say first, for folks that want to find you locally, is your music for sale in the area, or where can people find you to buy your music or to listen to you?
Just type in Felina's Arrow on the computer.
Okay.
And we come up.
FELINA S. Felina's Arrow. Check them out online. Or do you know of places locally that have your CDs for sale?
In Other Words does. Mm-hmm. And I believe...
iTunes and CD Baby.
Yeah.
The MySpace thing.
On MySpace.
Yeah, CD Baby is really easy to get it from. Which is local here, too. Which is really cool.
Nicely convenient like that. CD Baby here in Portland.
Or Another Words bookstore.
Another Words bookstore. Support your local bookstores, people. All right. What's the next song that we're going to hear?
Should we do the love song for the love story? Since we're on gay radio, that would be really gay.
More gay love songs. Here we go. What's this one called?
This is called Ashteru.
All right. And let's do a little technical setup. Use those mics for your voice and use this one for your guitars. All right, ladies?
Okay. Well, as cheesy as this is, I pulled half of the words out of my diary when we first met. 1, 2, 3, 4.
and we'll believe and fight for each other.
Tell me the name of that song again.
Aishteru.
Very nice. Very nice. For our listeners who are just tuning in, you are listening to Out Loud, KBOO's queer news and public affairs show. This live music is a local group named Felina's Arrow. They do have a couple of live gigs coming up. Let's our listeners know when they can see you play live if they're in the Portland area.
We are doing a very fun collaborative project on March 5th at the Hawthorne Theater. And I believe it's a 12-piece band altogether that we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
Awesome. And for those that don't know, the Hawthorne Theater, again, is at it's on Southeast Hawthorne at 39th, the building with the flames on it. And
at 7 p.m.
Show starts at 7. And then also Felina's Arrow is going to be part of the exciting lineup for the Madonna-thon happening this Thursday evening at the Hollywood Theater. And for those listeners who are not in the metro area, you can find Felina's Arrow on MySpace. Felina is spelled F-E-L-I-N-A apostrophe S, Felina's Arrow. So we have time for a little bit more discussion and then probably another song. But are there any thoughts you want to leave with our listeners or any messages you want to send out to the community?
Life is beautiful.
The deep and meaningful thoughts from musicians. Life is beautiful. We talked earlier, life is really a gift. We all, there's a precious member of our community that had a health crisis this week and really brings it home how important every day is.
For sure.
Love on your loved ones and celebrate the time you have. And, of course, be creative along the way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Those are my thoughts. And
do what inspires you. It's really important. This is the time you got, and do it.
Yeah.
Just do it.
I'm definitely grateful to be able to express myself the way that we do.
Yeah. It's nice. I really, I mean, I enjoy live music, and here we are on the radio, but I really love to see individuals that can find a way to make a living through their creative endeavors. And so props to all the musicians and the creative people in our community who are doing that. One more time, again, if you want to see Felina's Arrow play live, they're this Thursday at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Madonna-thon. Tons and tons of different musicians all doing Madonna covers. Doors at 6, show starts at 7, costumes encouraged. And then again, Felina's Arrow is part of a larger show, the Quadrophones at the Hollywood Theater on Hawthorne Theater, 39th and Hawthorne, on March 5th, which will be next week. So how about one more song to go out with?
Okay.
And I do want to, I'm going to say our goodbyes now. And listeners, when we come back to the Out Loud show, we're going to be speaking with some of the organizers from the Meaningful Care Conference. But before we get to our interview side of the show, we're going to hear one more song from Felina Zero. What's the name of this song?
The Pirate Song. Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I'd like to say hopefully we're going to see a lot more of you, but I know y'all are about to go out on tour. So we will miss you while you're gone.
But we will be back.
And when you come back to Portland, we will have you on the radio again one more time. So
all right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time on the radio. And again, you're listening to Felina's Arrow, and this is The Pirate Song.
Arr. Thank you. One and two and three and four.
Starting out my journey, walking out the norm. Footsteps farther from the door, I never belonged before. Just a few keepsakes to satisfy my needs. Memories get our photographs and my dog friend here with me. When the night sky is breathing, it blankets my passions and needs. At a loss for home I'm seeking. Maybe it's the love in my fence of borders, territories, rules attached to holy glory. Who's to follow the trails of sorrow? The price we pay is air and water. Do the illusion, myth, and number coded sacraments, imaginary lines and spaces that will again be claimed by nature. The illness is the medicine. Long live the damned. The longer I'm away, the more I'd like to stay. Mother's right, I just can't bite into the game they play.
Yeah.
Salud, amor, la vida.
yes.
You're listening to Out Loud, KBOO's Queer News and Public Affairs Show. My name is Carla. We were just listening to Felina's Arrow. That was the pirate song. So thanks to the ladies for playing live here in the KBOO studios. We're going to now move into a discussion around health care for the queer community. And I have with us in the studio Shad Alexander and Joseph Cedillo, who are both involved with the planning. And Shad is also a presenter at the Meaningful Care Conference. Welcome to the Out Loud Show, gentlemen.
Thank you, Carla.
Thanks for having us here.
And Joseph, are you presenting at the conference as well?
I am not actually presenting this year. I'm just involved in the marketing and outreach component of the conference.
Awesome. Well, maybe let's start with a little introduction for you guys, and that'll help explain why you're involved with the conference. So Shad, maybe tell us a little bit about your background or what brought you to being involved with the conference.
Well, I manage Swan House, which is one of the programs operated by our house, part of their continuum of care. It provides housing for people living with AIDS. I'm a therapist at Quest Center for Integrative Health, where we have a pretty large queer affirmative practice there. And most of my clientele there is queer. I wanted to get involved in this conference because I would just hear a lot of stories in the therapy office about people who had received some kind of mistreatment, you know, either small mistreatment or large mistreatment from physicians, from social workers, from case managers across the board. And I really wanted to help remedy that situation. And, you know, to be honest for myself, too, I've done things from a place of cultural incompetence. I've done things that have offended people. And so wanting to improve for myself my own competency, I attended the conference 3 years ago. And I learned a lot, and I really enjoyed it, and so I want to get involved in the planning committee for that, and I have been for the last 2 years.
Very nice. So that was Shad Alexander. And what's the workshop that you're going to be presenting?
I'm presenting a workshop called Finding Queer Wellness in an Unwell World. I'm going to look at a model of wellness, a holistic, integrative model, and then we're going to kind of pick that apart and find out where some health disparities, where some wellness disparities occur for queer and trans folks. And that'll really rely a lot on audience participation to provide some input around that as well so that we can have an idea of what wellness is and where does it become absent in queer communities.
Mm-hmm. And then next, let's hear from Joseph. And what's your background in the community and what brings you to this conference?
Well, first off, thanks for having us on the show. It's really good to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Like Carla said, my name is Joseph Cedillo. I work for Cascade AIDS Project. I actually run the Oregon AIDS and STD hotline for them. And what brings me here is, first of all, I have a passion for just LGBTQ health in general as an out gay man and having to seek health care and knowing the unique needs that come from that. It's really good to be a part of this whole experience. I also used to run the Men's Wellness Center, which is a space for gay and bi men, and I do a lot of HIV testing and counseling to that community, and realizing time and time again that community members need to know what to talk about with their doctors. I attended the conference last year, and I got a lot out of it, especially concerning trans issues, and so this year I really wanted to be a part of it, and so when I was asked, I stood up to the plate, and that's what brought me here.
Very nice. So tell us, what are some of the community partners that are involved with the, you know, behind the scenes, or who's sponsoring this conference?
Well, Multnomah County Health Department is a big one. Cascade AIDS Project, Outside In, just to name a few, the organization that Shad works for.
Our house, Quest Center for Integrative Health, SMRC, Breathe Free Oregon.
Yeah, it's really a kind of a beautiful partnership when you think about all the different people in the community that come to put on this conference. We've really had a good time setting this whole thing up, really seeing how people can come together and put on something that's really advocating for LGBTQ persons and getting the word out on cultural competency in the Oregon community.
Mm-hmm. Maybe let's talk for a minute. I've heard the words cultural competency. And for folks that aren't familiar, what does that mean?
Well, for myself as a therapist, when I'm meeting a new client and I'm interviewing them and assessing, you know, what their strengths are and what their problem areas are and what brings them into the therapy office, it's really important for me to understand that the people who come from queer communities, LGBTQ communities, have had different life experiences that, first of all, might result in them being uncomfortable seeking therapy, being uncomfortable with myself based on my ethnicity, my gender identity, my perceived sexual orientation, whether correct or not. And also recognizing that people have been really harmed in healthcare systems before, and so having some sensitivity to that. When people in queer and trans communities go to see a medical provider and the medical provider gets it wrong somehow,
mm-hmm.
That creates a huge disconnect for folks. And people then are put in a position of they either have to educate their provider or they keep their mouth shut and don't educate their provider, or they just plain don't go back. And through that generates disparities, healthcare disparities, where people don't get the services that they need. And so through cultural competency, we're wanting to work with providers to help them understand how to both be sensitive, you know, ask the right questions, and also have a willingness to accept they might not necessarily know everything about the person they're working with and might need some outside education or information.
Mm-hmm. And when we say providers, I just want to make sure our listeners are clear. We're talking about medical care providers or social service care providers. So we're really targeting people that are helping to take care of the queer community in many, many different ways. So for listeners that are just tuning in, we are discussing the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered Meaningful Care Conference. It's going to be happening here in Portland on Friday, March 13th. And tonight we have with us Shad and Joseph, who are both involved with the planning of the conference. So maybe let's talk about some of those health disparities and what's going on in the queer community to the point where the health outcomes are so different that these different community groups and healthcare providers would come together for this conference. What's going on with the health of our loved ones?
Well, I think you can take a look at LGBTQ youth, for one, in terms of the suicide rates being a lot higher in that population than the rest of the youth in the country. You talk about LGBTQ seniors, which is another area of focus for this year, where there's just not a lot of research being done and not a lot of competent care in that arena. And then you look at, you know, some cofactors of both like racism, people of different races, and also being LGBTQ. We're seeing those two factors combining to really have some huge health disparities. One other thing, in the trans community, again, there's so many barriers to health care. I mean, we look back at what was identified in 2004 as the priorities, and there's like 11 of them because, I mean, you think about suicide abuse or substance abuse and prevention, depression, even just looking at the larger picture of people getting murdered or harassed. And then you think about the DSM and looking at that categorization for people in gender identity disorder, being a classification for people needing to get that health care. So, I mean, that's just to name a few.
Mm-hmm. I heard some medical speak that people might not know. What is DSM when it comes to gender stuff? Talk about kind of in layman's terms.
Well, Shad's the therapist. I'll let him talk about that.
Well, okay.
The Diagnostic Statistical Manual is outlines what defines mental illness. And going back to the early 70s, homosexuality before that was in the book, but then was removed. And a lot of research and a lot of experience showed that being gay was not a mental illness. But then there's this large disparity or gap then for transgender or trans-identified people who to receive services currently, to receive mental health services, to be able to change your gender or your sex on your driver's license, to be able to move through life as your preferred gender as opposed to your birth gender, requires the diagnosis of gender identity disorder. That's a pretty controversial topic because the same research that showed that being gay is not a mental illness also tends to show that growing into a gender identity that's different than your biological sex is not necessarily a mental illness either. But that's where our country is right now. And if you were to take that diagnosis off the books, then people would be denied care. If you leave the diagnosis on the books, then people become stigmatized. And so, and there are, you know, within, you know, queer and trans communities, there are people on both sides of the fence who are really trying to think that decision through and what is in the best needs of health care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a very complicated issue. And what are some of the other, I guess let's go to the conference itself, you know, that this is, the conference is targeting or it's hoping that individuals in the medical field, individuals who provide social services of some sorts, what are some of the types of workshops that these people can take?
Well, just going back to the trans issue, there is a Trans 101 workshop. I want to take a step back and say the great thing about the conference is that there are varying levels of education that are going on. I mean, we have some presenters that are doing sort of a basic understanding. So, if I were a doctor and I just had no idea about any sort of the trans issues or what that's going to look like, I could go to a beginner's level as well as all the way up to advanced. And that's really working with providers who do have some cultural competency around these issues and being able to further their knowledge and a sharing of best practices, if you will. I mean, when I look at the schedule, I mean, we have 20 different presentations that, you know, people can choose from. And it's amazing to see all these presenters coming from all over the city. I believe we have some coming from outside of the Portland area itself. And really trying to educate doctors, social service providers, counselors, mental health therapists.
School nurses.
I mean, you name it. I think anybody can really benefit from this. I think sometimes coming from a patient advocacy standpoint, we always assume that the doctor knows everything. And when I speak specifically about general practice or family physicians, they are required to know a huge amount of information. I mean, all over the place. You know a little bit about tons of topics. And so I think we can all use a little bit more education and competence, if you will, especially around LGBTQ healthcare issues.
I like the way our discussion is going, and I want to talk a little bit more about our workshops, but I think the list of workshops is on the conference website. So maybe let's go ahead and share that. What is the conference website?
You can find that at LGBTQ, meaningful care, all one word, .org. So LGBTQ, meaningful care, .org. I also want to point out, too, for the workshops, we're offering both CEUs and CMUs, so continuing education units for people in the social services industry and continuing medical education for people in the medical field. 6 units.
Mm-hmm. And how much does it cost, the conference?
The conference actually costs $65 for participants and then $50 for students.
Okay, and it's all day on Friday, March 13th?
That is correct.
Okay, and I did do a little bit of research online, and I found some information about your keynote speaker. Sounds like somebody very interesting. So this was someone coming from out of town, and who would like to speak for a minute about Joel Ginsberg?
Well, I'll just say a little bit. Joel Ginsberg is actually the current executive director for the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, which is a national association of gay and lesbian medical providers. He's been instrumental in creating several things, but one I want to highlight right now is basically they did this health equity index and looking at what are the priorities for the gay and lesbian GLBTQ community in terms of what we need for culturally competent care. And the GLMA, or Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, and Human Rights Campaign actually partnered in that to really identify those and give us some advice both for providers and for patients in saying what we need to do on a policy level, what we need to do on a patient level, and what we need to do on a provider level.
And what are some of those things?
Well, they identified that we need to work on LGBTQ youth, that we need to look at LGBT people of color, looking at gay and lesbian women that are at more risk for certain kinds of diseases or cancer. And also we just look at HIV/AIDS continues to be a a huge issue, especially in the gay men's community. Oregon actually has a higher rate than the national average, being 70% of new HIV infections are in the gay and bisexual men's communities.
Mm. I hadn't realized that. So say that again. In Oregon, we are unique versus the national average. And say those numbers again.
So 70% of all new HIV infections in Oregon happen in the gay bisexual men's community. Whereas if you look at on a national average, it tends to be about half of new HIV infections.
That's
quite a disparity.
It is. Nothing to be proud of, but a perfect example of why we need this kind of conference. And for those that are listening, I just want to offer some perspective from a woman's point of view. And again, I know you guys have plenty. We all have personal stories of things that have happened at the doctor's office behind closed doors that are a little uncomfortable. And one example, all of us women, when we get our paperwork, we have to fill in that blank of what type of birth control do we use. And if you leave that blank, that space blank, you're going to be asked by the nurse, by the doctor, by the person who takes your blood pressure, by everybody who talks to you, what kind of birth control do you use? And I've learned to put on that line, women. They don't ask me anymore.
What type of birth control do I use?
Well, Carla, there's this... In states that do domestic partnership and that allow health insurance under domestic partnership, there's an interesting phenomenon popping up where women are being denied mammograms because their same-sex partners, the person who holds the insurance policy, and for whatever reason that insurer cannot put it in their little computer box that woman partnered with woman, as opposed to, the computer just automatically assumes that the domestic partner is a man, and so that the healthcare gets shut down in those states.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one small example. There are a lot of examples where, disparities arise around small policy issues.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good example. And for those listeners, if there are actually any listeners who think that this conference is not needed, talk to your gay and lesbian friends. We all have personal stories of being treated uncomfortably or just flat out inappropriately in the doctor's office. And so I'm so thankful that this conference is happening. And I think here in Portland, our healthcare is probably a little bit more progressive. But again, I know a lot of young people here or trans people here. I mean, there are still a lot of improvements to be made in the healthcare in the city. But also, I mean, out in rural Oregon, the healthcare is very, very different.
And we're challenging people to also talk to your physicians, talk to your therapists, talk to your social service providers. And so some of us are fortunate enough they have culturally competent, queer affirmative doctors, and that's great. Well, talk to your doctors. Let them know. Thank them. Let them know how comfortable you feel with them and how important that is, and have them talk to their colleagues. Have them come to this conference, too, so that they can further their education, their colleagues can get education. And for those of us who are not fortunate enough to have culturally competent doctors, please, please invite your providers to attend the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it means a heck of a lot more coming from the patient themselves saying, this is what I'm going through, these are my issues, and I think it's really important for you as my service provider to, educate yourselves. And I think we can't emphasize enough that you need to get those CEUs and CMEs that continue education anyway. Why not do it around LGBTQ healthcare?
Mm-hmm. And that's where that personal invitation, I know I talked to my healthcare provider and thanked her. She is very competent, but she also works at Kaiser. And I know, not to badmouth Kaiser, because I'm thankful for my health insurance, but I know that there are providers within Kaiser that are not competent. And so I thanked my healthcare provider and then said, please tell your coworkers who you know. She knows people who have issues or who do not provide appropriate medical care, and for her to invite her colleagues to participate. And so I think those one-on-one conversations that we have with our own healthcare people can really go a long way.
Well, especially when you look at the evaluations from last year's conference the overwhelming majority of people saying that they got something new, that they got something relevant, that they got something tangible that they could take with them to really increase their competency around their LGBTQ patients. I mean, in reality, in a state of the nation as it is, and the healthcare issues that we have, I mean, we can only strengthen the care that we're giving, and especially in communities that have disparities like the queer community.
Mm-hmm. So maybe let's touch on a few more of the workshops. I mean, we talked about the Staying Well in an Unwell World, and Chad, you're going to be presenting that one. What are some of the other topics that are going to be discussed, or some of the other workshop focuses?
Well, our keynote speaker, Joel Ginsberg, is doing a presentation, Understanding the Healthcare Needs of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Persons. We have a number of sessions that are divided by whether the person's a beginner level of knowledge, an intermediate level of knowledge, or an advanced level of knowledge. And so even people who feel like they're pretty competent would be able to walk away from this conference with some new information.
I was also speaking to an individual who's doing a presentation on looking at the intersection of being Latino identified and also queer identified. So, I mean, it's really so many valuable things that you can get. And the great thing about it is there's basically four sessions that you choose based on what you want. So you can say, I want to do all trans health all day long. That's what I really need to get some work on. Or you can look at, I need some more help working and talking to gay and bisexual men, or I need some help talking to lesbian or some lesbian-identified individuals, or perhaps I want to learn about more working with queer youth or homeless youth. I think that's why there's really something for everybody.
There's a couple of workshops, too, about advocacy. One called Educate, Advocate, and Inspire, Personal Storytelling to Promote Cultural Competence in Healthcare. So teaching people how to speak to providers and providers how to speak to their professional organizations about these issues, how to create safe spaces for LGBTQ youth. So you know, we're taking the stance that advocacy is definitely very important in overcoming the health disparities.
Mm-hmm. I like that there's you mentioned that there are specific subject areas. Like if someone, you know, maybe they're already feeling comfortable with, the information they have, but they need more information on trans issues or the specific youth issues. And are there workshops for seniors or other, like those, you mentioned the Latino community. So those specific populations within our larger community. So I think that's great.
There are workshops for seniors.
No, there are providers working with seniors, not just for seniors.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. And is there anything special about this year versus past years? You mentioned, like, how many years has this conference been going on?
We're in our fourth year.
Okay.
Well, our size of participants, our registrants has grown. Our size of presenters has grown. And this year, too, we're also offering some awards for local providers and local organizations that have really proven to be champions in this field of LGBTQ health care competency.
I just want to piggyback on that point real quick is that, you know, there are, we talk a lot about the disparities and the negative side of how we aren't getting enough, but there are definitely those people out there that do have, are very competent, that are really providing really good health care. You think about the Trans Health Clinic, the Oregon. I mean, lots of these organizations that really are out there and doing the right thing, and how much that can benefit the community and hearing those stories from people saying, actually, I did get everything I needed for once.
Mm-hmm. And the conference was conceived, at the Multnomah County level. People wanted to overcome all healthcare disparities and then broke it out in different ways to address that. And so the office of Maria Rojo De Steffi was a huge champion for promoting and getting this conference started. So at the political level, too, we have allies, we have champions.
Very nice. Well, we need to wrap things up, but I wanted to say thank you. We've been speaking with Shad Alexander, who's going to be one of the presenters at the Meaningful Care Conference, and he's also been involved with the planning. And we've also been speaking with Joseph Cedillo, who is one of the planners as well. Would you gentlemen like to leave our listeners with any closing thoughts?
Well, first of all, we'd encourage you to go to the website, www.lgbtqmeaningfulcare.org. As a standpoint in advocacy, please, if you are queer identified, talk to your providers, social service providers, doctors, nurses. Encourage them to come to the conference. They won't be disappointed.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, gentlemen. And I just want to say the website one more time, LGBTQMeaningfulCare.org. I found it online just by searching for Meaningful Care Conference. It came right up. So thank you so much to you for your work on that. And again, that conference is happening Friday, March 13th. Now, to wrap up the show, I just want to share some community announcements. On Friday, March 6th, which is a week from this Friday, there's going to be a rally in Salem titled Stand Out and Stand Up. Join Basic Rights Oregon and the Queer Resource Center at Portland State University to help get anti-bullying legislation passed in Oregon. This Stand Up for Youth and Stand Out for Equality rally is happening again Friday, March 6th in Salem. Come out and show your support for the community. Transportation and lunch will be provided, but you must register ahead of time. Many of us already know that every day in every school, students across Oregon are bullied just because they don't fit in. And when lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth are bullied for being who they are, their success in school, their mental health, and their physical safety are all threatened. We'll stand up for LGBT youth when we rally on the Capitol steps and when we lobby our legislators to strengthen Oregon's anti-bullying law. That's Friday, March 6th, all day in Salem. To register and find out more, go to the Basic Rights Oregon website at www.basicrights.org. I also want to let any gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender listener know that you can earn $25 to $1,000 for your personal story. Spiral River Productions is seeking stories for a book, and it's conducting a writing contest. The purpose of the book is to reflect the authentic lives of LGBT individuals all over the world. Stories should be inspirational, true, and about people exhibiting the noble qualities of humanity, like kindness, generosity, authenticity, friendship, love, courage, learning a life lesson. You get the idea. You can get more information about the contest at spiralriver.com. Stories are due by March 31st, 09. Also, there's a survey that's calling all queer Muslims. Al-Fatiha invites you to participate in the historic survey of Muslims who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer, and questioning, or exploring their gender identity and sexual orientation, including Muslims who use other cultural and ethnic terms to refer to their own experience. This survey is for Muslims of all cultural and ethnic backgrounds and Muslims of all beliefs and practices, including observant, cultural Muslims, and those who are secular. This is the first survey of its kind. The survey results will tell the community about the experiences and their concerns. All answers are anonymous and confidential. You can find out more information at the Al-Fatiha website. It's www.al-fatiha.org. I'd also like to say a huge congratulations to the Q Center, which is Portland's queer community center. They successfully moved into their new home last weekend, and a big thank you to everyone who helped with the move. You can find them now at 4115 North Mississippi, just south of Skidmore, or online at www.pdxqcenter.org. I want to say thank you so much for listening. My name is Carla. It's always a joy to bring you this queer programming. Until next time, stay proud and live out loud.
The time is 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO-FM in Portland. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio, but first, these news headlines.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
U.S. prosecutors asked a judge to sentence Monzer Al-Kassar, a Syrian arms dealer convicted of conspiring to sell weapons worth $1 million to Colombian rebels, to decades in prison. Al-Kassar, described by prosecutors as one of the world's most prolific arms dealers, was convicted in November of agreeing to sell weapons to the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. U.S. government faced mounting pressure Monday to put billions more dollars in some of the nation's biggest banks, two of the biggest automakers, and the biggest insurance company, despite the billions it has already committed to rescuing them. The Obama administration confirmed it was in discussions to aid Citigroup, the recipient of $45 billion so far, that could raise the government's stake in the bank to 40%. With the enactment of a large economic stimulus package, fiscal conservatives are using the temporary deficit increase to attack Social Security and Medicare. Republicans claim these costs will depress economic growth and crowd out other needed outlays, such as investments in the young.
Top of the hour news brought to you by INN World Report.
John Thain, former CEO of Merrill Lynch, is staying mum about the billion-dollar bonuses he approved just weeks before Merrill Lynch came under the control of Bank of America. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, who is investigating the controversial Merrill bonuses, has filed a motion in court seeking to compel Thain to talk. Cuomo's office says during a meeting with investigators last week, Thain refused to do so, claiming Bank of America has told him to keep quiet. Cuomo's office is alleging that Bank of America is obstructing his investigation. That probe is seeking to determine what Bank of America knew and when about Merrill's decision to award the bonuses and about the $27 billion in losses Merrill absorbed in the fourth quarter of last year before it was formally taken over by Bank of America. Writing in the New York Times, Nobel laureate Paul Krugman criticizes the Obama administration for coming up with alternatives to nationalization that involve huge handouts to bank stockholders. Krugman says the administration has flouted the idea of offering banks guarantees against losses on troubled assets. This would have been a great deal for bank stockholders, but not the rest of us. Now the administration is talking about a public-private partnership to buy troubled assets from the banks, with the government lending money to private investors for that purpose. To end their zombiehood, Krugman says the banks need more capital. But since they can't raise capital from private investors, they have to turn to the government.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, February 24th, 2009. The PSU Professional Development Center offers a free workshop today for students looking to increase their current skills and marketability. Program managers and instructors will be on hand to discuss courses and professional certificates. The information session takes place Tuesday, February 24th, that's today, from 5 to 7 p.m., and is free and open to the public. RSVP appreciated. pdc.pdx.edu/infossession, info session. Location is PSU, Portland State University, at 1515 Southwest Market Street, Portland. The Socialist Party of Oregon hosts a public forum tonight from 8:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue. Speakers, free and informal. For more information, call Walt Brown at 503-636-4150. The Children of the Revolution will be discussing political and social issues on Wednesday, February 25th from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the People's Food Co-op at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell. Call 503-232-9051 to confirm. Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church conducts weekly Divorce Care for Kids programs to help children heal from the pain of divorce and separation. Everyone is welcome each Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street. Information and links are at the church website, www.mounttaborchurch.net. Wednesday, February 25th, there will be a Food Not Bombs produce share in Southeast Portland. Help yourself to free produce, tofu, and other items gleaned from local natural food stores and suppliers between 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. Produce share items are in boxes and tubs on the front porch of 5224 Southeast Boise, Portland, just off Southeast 52nd between Foster and Holgate on bus routes 71 and 14. Fresh, free meal on a cold winter's night, attend Food Not Bombs, a free vegan dinner spread held beginning at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesdays at Colonel Summers Park, Southeast 17th and Taylor, and on Wednesdays at Southeast 63rd and Foster. Bring your own containers. There's a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, February 25th at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. David Rothman, concert pianist, takes a break from his all Chopin marathon by performing two Beethoven piano sonatas, opuses 110 and 111. This has been Paula for the Community Calendar for KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio transmitting from Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.